Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, you need to consider all kinds of things. When you garden, you look at soil type, climate change. What about new technologies? Today on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at how we've changed our gardening practices and what the future may hold with our guest, horticulturist, TV host, disabilities activist Mark Lane has a new book out. It's called The Future of Gardens, and we're going to talk with him about the book and take a look at the future of gardens. And I'm wondering, how have your gardening practices, how have they changed in the last decade or so? Are you concerned with changes in climate and how it's going to affect your garden? Are you interested in helping to design maybe an accessible garden? I know Mark does a lot of garden design work. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mark Lane, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us. And you're sitting at home in the UK, if I'm not mistaken.
You're absolutely right, Larry, and thank you so much for having me.
You know, here in the U.S., we have national days. Every day there seems to be a national day. And today, turns out, happens to be National Knockout Rose Day. It always comes the Friday before our Mother's Day.
Ah, gotcha, gotcha.
Are you a knockout rose guy or not?
I've got a love-hate relationship with roses, I've got to admit.
I think you start to talk and chill. What's your question?
When I was a kid, you know, my grandmother used to make us go out there and pick off all the green fly and black fly and pick up all the black spotted leaves. So I've sort of got this hate relationship with them. But I do love roses to look at.
You know, at the start of your book, you talk about how, you know, your life and how you got interested. And I thought it was fascinating. Talk about how you got involved in gardening.
Next week on
Oh, we're having a few technical difficulties here, Mark. So I think we'll get that. I'm not hearing you now, so we'll get it straightened out in just a minute here. Mark Lane, our guest, the author of The Future of Gardens, and The Future of Gardens is the official title of the book. And in it, he, of course, talks about a lot of the work that's going on around the world to take advantage of technology and then with an eye to climate change and a lot of other things. And I think we've got him back. Are you there, Mark?
Yeah, Larry.
Okay, good. Now, let's talk about how you got involved, a little more about how you got involved in gardening, because you started way back.
I did. I think like most people, actually, who love gardening, it was because of my grandparents. My grandfather on my father's side used to love growing vegetables. So at the end of the garden, there was a huge vegetable patch. And my grandmother was a flower arranger. So she taught me, when I was probably about sort of 5 or 6, the importance of sort of shape, colour, form, texture, scent, and all of that, and how to put it all together. And then, as I just mentioned, on my mother's side, the garden was just full of roses. So that's where that love-hate relationship came from. But, my grandparents taught me, you know, even now when I'm doing stuff on TV or I'm writing in books, there's always that lovely little memory that I have. And I think that's what gardening is. It's those wonderful memories that you have over the years. And also, you know, that whole idea that actually gardening doesn't discriminate on anything. You can be there out there on your own gardening. You could be there with a group. And just being out there with your grandparents, I think, is a very special moment.
I would definitely agree with that. What drove you to write a book about the future of gardens?
That's a very good question. I was approached by the publishers. So the publishers have done this wonderful series called The Future Of, and it includes many, many very varied topics from Egyptology to the future of the novel, etc. I'd always been fascinated about technology and how that sort of incorporates into gardening and horticulture in general. So when they approached me, I was like, oh, yes, I know exactly what sort of thing I want to write about. And of course, I'm a huge sci-fi fan. So bringing all of that together was a wonderful thing to do. And hopefully it's come out in a book which people will enjoy.
I definitely think they will. I certainly enjoyed reading it. And your research, you know, England, the UK, I'm thinking back now here about 10, 12 years. I along with a bunch of really fine gardeners who listened to Wisconsin Public Radio, we visited England, and we saw the Hampton Court Garden Show, and we visited gardens, all Ham House, Great Dixter, I'm trying to remember, Sissinghurst, Canterbury, Cathedral, Old Buckhurst, Goodenstone Park Gardens, some community gardens, and a lot of private gardens. And I tell you, gardeners have it together in England. But
we are a nation of gardeners. I think we always have been, and I just think that there are some incredible examples here in the UK, and it's. I find it fascinating now because obviously being able to go into gardens for TV and being there when, you know, the public aren't around or when there's not a lot of masses, I feel very privileged to be able to do that. But also, it's fascinating to talk to the head gardeners as well to see how they're actually having to change sort of historic gardening because of the changing climate. So it's how they're having to adapt now because they're having to. But we are a nation of gardeners, and I think that's what's so special really about the UK. Whether you're in the south or way up north in Scotland and beyond, you'll always find a garden.
And you went beyond the UK, though, in your research. You did a lot of research, which I found really interesting, on what's going on around the world. Were you surprised by what you found?
Not really. I mean, I sort of know that people in horticulture generally, with a capital H, are very inquisitive types of people. And they're very glued on and clued on about climate, about sustainability and biodiversity. And, you know, as gardeners anyway, if we're outside the whole time, we notice the changes in the weather, we notice the changes in the soil. So it doesn't really matter where you are in the world, you know, everyone's having to grow stuff and adapt stuff considering what their climate is actually like. So, no, it didn't really surprise me. But I think the thing that did surprise me the most was beyond this planet and going into space and Mars and what's being done there is very, very fascinating. But I think there is that overarching belief that we as gardeners can make a difference. And whether it's small steps or whether it's large steps, when you put them all together, they can make a very big, large difference to the world in terms of climate change and resilient planting. So, I think it's I think it's wonderful to see that, you know, places in Australia, in Africa, in America, in China, wherever you go, there's always some research somewhere that is looking into all of this. And I think that's important because we have to, as a worldwide people, we have to do that.
You quoted William Kent in the foreword of your book, and you said garden, who said garden as though you'll live forever. What's behind that? Why did you want to include that?
I wanted to include that because, A, I think we have been gardening forever. But the whole notion of forever, I think, is a very interesting one, especially when it comes to gardening and even garden design. And I actually mentioned in the book that as a garden designer, many people have said to me that you're creating the sort of living legacies. And I never really thought of my design work as being that. So in that sense, you know, your designs and the planting will live on forever, unless, of course, someone comes in with a bulldozer and chops it all up and starts all over again. Yeah. And I think that is what's so special about creating sort of outdoor spaces in any part of the world, is that fact that it can be there for a very long time. And, you know, gardens never sit still. They're always constantly changing. And so because of that, that notion of forever is apt, because the gardens and gardening will always continue no matter what. So that forever notion, I think, is hopefully one that sort of stands out throughout the book, really.
Talking today with Mark Lane, he is the author of The Future of Gardens, and talking with him about the book and about gardens. And you may have a garden, a flower question, or maybe a question about the role of gardens in the future. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You talk about AI in the book today, artificial intelligence. What are some ways AI is being used today in gardening? We've lost some sound again. So we're gonna hold on, Mark. If you can hear me, we're having some difficulties for some reason today with our sound. Usually things work pretty well here on Garden Talk. Mark Lane, our guest, as we talk with him about the future of gardening, and there's a lot in his book. He talks about smart plant and garden tags. Those are a couple of the apps that he talks about. And I'm not sure if he's hearing me. Are you hearing me now, Mark? I'm seeing him, but I'm not knowing if he's hearing me.
I can hear you, Larry, but I've just been informed that our Zoom link is going to be ending shortly. So I'm going to be sent a new link.
All right. Well, in the meantime, let's just keep talking.
Yes, exactly. Why not?
Why not? Live radio. That's how it works. Do you ever run into things like this as well? No, let's not get into that. You talk about AI in your book, and let's talk about some of the ways AI is used today in gardening.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think whenever you hear the words AI, people, you know, sort of think of the worst sort of situations, because, you know, who's policing it? Where is that information actually coming from? But when you actually think about AI and the fact that it's a whole load of algorithms that we never see sort of going off into the ether that come up with all of these incredible pieces of information, I think personally, from a gardening point of view, having AI as an assistant is actually a very positive thing. I think it's going to help a lot of people, a lot of gardeners. I think it's going to help the way that we sort of address what we grow, whether it's produce or whether it's ornamentals. And I think it's just one of those things whereby we have to sort of take it carefully. And I think it always comes down to choice at the end of the day. It's a bit like when, you know, I remember when the internet suddenly sort of became very large and everyone panicked about the internet and worried about security and everything else. I think it's exactly the same with AI. It's that same sort of scare moment where a new piece of technology comes through and everyone starts to panic. But actually, in the long term, I think it's going to be a good thing. And also, we've got to remember that actually quite a lot of stuff that we already use in the garden, whether that's from smart irrigation systems or whether it's through sort of soil sensors, already use AI. They already use this software already. So, you know, we shouldn't be scared of it. It's something that we should just love. And I think it's just going to get better as the years go on. But I am still concerned, and this comes back from when I used to be a publisher, who is going to be policing that information, and is that information going to be correct? Because obviously, you know, if you're dealing with living plants and you're given some information and that's the information given to you and you believe it's right, and you then start feeding your plant, watering or whatever, and it's completely wrong, then of course your living plant is going to die. So that information, wherever that comes from, has somehow got to be policed. And how that's done, I don't think anyone really knows that at the moment. But, you know, I still think it's a good thing to happen, and it is already there. It's already in gardening products already.
It is indeed. I have one. I'm just looking at my phone now. I have one that you mentioned, as a matter of fact. It's called Garden Tags.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, I mentioned this in the book, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have these devices that we could just sort of press a button and get all this information. And yet now we do. We have them, you know, our phones are our life, and simple apps make life easier. And if it means that, you know, just by pressing a button or taking a photograph or something, and those AI algorithms doing what they need to do can give you that information almost instantly, I only see that as a positive. So I think it's a good thing to have. It's just whether or not everybody else will think it's a good thing as things progress, I suppose.
Mark Lane, our guest today, as we talk with him about the future of gardens. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here visiting to begin the show with Mark Lane, and he's written a new book. It's titled The Future of Gardens, and looking forward to talking more with him as we move along. And you can join in with your own questions. What do you want to know about technology in the garden, or do you have a garden question? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. And quick note, following Mark's visit, we'll be talking with Susan Carpenter, the native plant garden curator at the Arboretum, the UW-Madison Arboretum, and she'll have some updates on their plant sale, what's blooming in the Arboretum right now. And I bet the lilacs are blooming, among other things. Oh, gosh. Well, you talk a lot about AI in the book, and we've talked about what other technology is going to be important for gardeners, Mark?
Well, obviously, you know, both Wisconsin and here in the UK, and I know the rest around the world, everyone's being affected by climate change. So we are seeing, you know, more rain, we're seeing hotter summers. So the sort of technology that we'll be seeing will be very much down the sort of smart gardening route. So that's very much about smart irrigation systems. So there's much more less waste when it comes to water, of course, because water is a very precious source. Also down to sort of collecting rainwater as well, sort of more efficiently as well. And also things like sensors. So sensors that can go into the soil or even onto the plants themselves, which will actually tell you how a plant is doing, whether it's surviving and loving its life, or whether or not it needs to be fed with a particular fertilizer, or the soil needs to be improved in some way. And I think, you know, that sort of technology, which is already here, I think is a great help. But also, you know, one step further to that is actually sort of looking at the plants themselves, and then also seeing how plants themselves can be used as biosensors. So those biosensors will then give us the information that we actually need. And I think that area is extremely interesting because obviously we're not reliant on a little chip or plastic, which has to sort of hold together some kind of irrigation system or whatever it might be. You're just reliant on the plants. And that's, I think, is really important. And of course, as we notice these hotter summers and of course these wetter winters, we're going to have to adapt our type of plants that we're going to grow as well. And I think that's where sort of plant breeding is going to sort of really take a new sort of stand into the future, because with, especially with things like AI will be able to start be seeing whether a particular strain or a particular cultivar is going to do very well in certain areas because of excess heat or excess water. So we'll start to see, I think, sort of more interesting plants coming through, which will probably be quite resilient. They'll be sort of based a lot on native plants, because we know that native plants are more resilient than the more sort of tropical and hybridized plants that we see so much in gardens. And so because of that, we're going to have to sort of see ways in which we can improve these plants. And that's where I think this AI technology will really help that. Then, of course, you know, you can go sort of one step further. And I think, you know, we've got AI. So I think the next stage will be something like augmented reality. So whether that means, you know, sitting outside in your deck chair or on your knees when you're gardening, wearing some goggles, it will give you another way of looking at a plant or looking at your border or your pots or your containers, because it will be able to overlay information. You'll be able to do it in real time. You'll be able to see the pros and the cons for doing things in different ways. And I think that is a fascinating area because it's going to open up the way that we look at plants and the way we look at our own gardens in a very different light. But of course, again, you know, it comes back what I said right at the beginning, it will always come down to choice. You know, we will have to decide whether or not we want to use that augmented reality, or whether we want to use the information that the augmented reality gives us. And then, you know, there are very exciting things that are going on because of land scarcity. So things like vertical gardening. We're even seeing sort of vertical gardening systems coming through into the domestic market. And I think that's really interesting, because also you can look at hydroponics, you look at aeroponics as well. So it gets away from that sort of having to rely on soil, but being able to grow plants that are both productive, are going to look great, and give you something, you know, that you can eat and be very sort of nutritious as well. So there's lots of things going on in the background, but lots of things that are currently already here. And I hope that throughout the book, it actually shows the future of gardens in a positive light. It's not all doom and gloom, despite the changing climate and us having to be adaptable and resilient, because, you know, there is hope. And it almost goes back to that lovely David Attenborough clip that I heard earlier, just a minute ago, on your station, where he said, you know, the ocean will be able to bounce back. And I think that's very true when it comes to gardens. It might take a bit longer, but I think they will be able to bounce back. And, you know, who knows? You know, if we get to the point where we all suddenly decide to leave this planet and go further afield, wouldn't it be lovely to think that the future of the planet will be covered in greenery because nature has taken it back?
Yeah. Well, we've seen kind of situations like that. I was thinking about areas of the world where we had a nuclear breakdown, and that area had to be, you know, eliminated by, you know, people couldn't be there.
Yeah.
And nature just kind of took off.
I know. See, that's what I think is is very heartwarming, actually, when you see sort of whether it's a dilapidated building or whether it's a site like you just mentioned, Larry, the fact that nature is resilient, and I think it does always bounce back, even after a nuclear fallout. I think that's a lovely thought to have, in the sense that even if us as stewards of the land, because let's face it, as gardeners, we are just stewards of the land for a limited time, we can make a little bit of a difference, but it's going to be nature at the end of the day that decides where it really wants to go in the future.
Yeah, yeah. Here's an interesting email from Margaret, who's in Cambridge, Wisconsin. And she asks, well, if robots or computers are growing or making our food, is a garden still a garden if a human isn't kind of tending it?
Oh, that's a good question, Margaret. It's funny enough, I mean, I do sort of highlight this in the book, but I think a garden will always be a garden, because I think at the end of the day, as gardeners, we like getting our hands dirty. You know, we know the benefits of being outside, surrounded by nature, getting our hands in the soil, releasing serotonin in our brain. So I don't think that will ever go. I think we'll always be there. We'll always be doing the gardening. I think, you know, yes, we might have a little, I mean, we have robot lawnmowers, obviously, going around clipping our lawns. I think it might be a little few more years yet until we start seeing robots doing the gardening for us. Of course, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, just like the automobile industry, you know, you can have robotic arms coming through, picking plants, pricking them, putting them on into soil or into hydroponics. But when it comes to the general gardener, I think that will always be there, because we just love our green spaces, and it doesn't have to be, you know, a huge garden. It can just be a few pots on a windowsill, or a few pots, you know, on a balcony or a roof garden. It doesn't matter what you do or what you grow, just being able to plant or sow a seed, watching it grow, nurturing it, is something very special. And I think it's sort of analogous to our own lives, in a sense. You know, we're born, we grow, and at the end of it, we die. And, you know, there's something, again, very heartwarming in being able to see this plant and nurturing that plant through. So I think, Margaret, I think don't worry yet. I still think we've got quite a way to go, but I think a garden, it will always be a garden, even if robots do decide to take over the world.
Interesting email from Dennis. Because of his physical limitations, he sold his property. He says he wishes he had thought of letting volunteer gardeners grow food for a charity pantry. Apartment renters might want a garden for food donations. If gardeners' time limitations preclude bigger gardens, property owners might have additional space and allow volunteers to plant multiple rows for donation. These can be teaching opportunities for novices to determine if they want to be gardeners.
I think that's a lovely idea. I mean, we're seeing a lot of that here in the UK, where the elderly population who just are finding gardening just maybe a little bit too tricky, or maybe it's someone with a disability who's finding gardening a little bit tricky, they're opening their gardens up, and they're allowing people to come in and to grow some fruit and veg, or just attend a part of the garden. And, you know, it's like what I said at the beginning, you know, gardening can be done on your own, or it can be a social activity. And, you know, I think it's wonderful that you can allow these people in and they can do that, because, you know, I don't know, do you have allotments in Wisconsin? Do you have allotments?
We have community gardens
We have allotments, which are just, you know, these patches of land where people can grow their own fruit and veg, etc. But the waiting lists to get on them are huge. I mean, some people can wait 10 years to actually get their own plot. So being able to open up some gardens and sharing that produce, I think, is a lovely sort of social activity to do. And, you know, it brings people together. It helps with isolation as well. And yeah, it's just, and again, it sort of it shows the power of plants and gardens.
Carol emailed, this is more maybe a technical type question. Carol emailed to ask, if you use biochar, and if so, what are the pros and cons?
So biochar is brilliant because actually it will add nutrients back into the soil. It will also sort of help sequester carbon as well. So that means, you know, there's less carbon dioxide in the air. It will also, as it breaks down, it will start to help the plant go in search of nutrients, in search of carbohydrates, sugars, etc., everything that it needs. So it's a wonderful thing to add to your garden. And actually, it's interesting because things like biochar and hotbeds have almost been forgotten about, especially here in the UK. And it's only been in the last probably 5 to 10 years that we're starting to see biochar come onto the market. And I'm really pleased to see that because, you know, it has, for organic gardening, it's works brilliantly. And I urge everyone to garden organically because, A, it's better for the environment, but also, you know, it helps wildlife and the natural world in many, many, many ways. So, yeah, I think, you know, biochar is an amazing, amazing thing to use, and we should be using it more. And I hope that as the years go on and people become more aware of it, that they will do.
Yeah, and for those who may not be familiar, biochar is a sort of a black carbon produced from biomass sources.
Yeah, exactly.
Wood chips, exactly. Plant residues, manure, other ag waste products.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty cool. Well, I know you're interested in space, and your chapter on the growing experiment on the International Space Station I thought was really interesting. Talk about those projects and how these efforts will help us garden into the future.
Well, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, yes, you know, they have grown things like lettuces and beets and what have you on the International Space Station. You've got to remember that on Earth, plants grow by what's known as gravitropism. So in other words, gravity. So therefore, you know, the roots go down and the tips go up. But in space, you don't have that. So they've had to create these special chambers where they can grow plants in them so they know which way is up and which way is down. But also, when you think about sort of being in space, or when you think about sort of space exploration and especially travel, actually doing the act of gardening, and you know, that it could be just tending to some lettuces, actually sort of grounds you back in an Earth environment. So it actually gives you that wonderful idea that actually, you know, it links you back to Earth, and I think that's so important. But also, we got to remember that, you know, if we do go to Mars or beyond, they're long journeys. So, you know, the astronauts are going to have to be fed. Yes, they can have lots of dry stuff, but it's also really good to have nutritious veggies and maybe fruits that you can grow yourself, which will be even better. And then, of course, you know, you've got to think about sort of what's known as closed loop systems. So things like human poop, etc., will be recycled, so that can then be used as a compost. So it's a very, I think it's a fascinating area because, A, you're having to deal with no gravity. B, you're having to think of how you're going to feed these astronauts on these long journeys. See, you know, once you get to somewhere like Mars, which doesn't have many natural resources or an abundance of water, how are we going to feed and water our plants? So that's where the closed loop systems come in. So I think it's an absolutely fascinating point in our history. I hope, and I really hope, that I will see it in our time that, you know, we'll get onto Mars and we'll start growing stuff there. I do remember when my book first came out that someone said to me, well, as a garden designer, you're not going to get many jobs on Mars. And I said, well, no, that's very true, unless it's in some kind of biosphere or something. But I think it's a fascinating aspect. If we can use that as well as an educational tool, which I know they're doing with the International Space Station and schools, where they can sort of dial in and see what's going on, then all the better for it. And again, isn't it wonderful to know that just by sowing a seed and growing something in space can connect us back to Earth?
Oh, you know what? That's a good way to wind up today, Mark. That was so much fun talking with you today. I really appreciate your time today. We didn't get into a tenth of what you cover here in The Future of Gardens, your book, but I hope a lot of people get a chance to read it. And thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Lane, the author of the book, The Future of Gardens. Mark's a pretty cool guy, and he's an award-winning garden designer, a broadcaster. Of course, he appears on BBC very, very often. Fun talking with him. And it'll be fun talking next to our guest, who is with the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. We're going to talk about native plants, and you can call in with your questions about your own native plants. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Carpenter. She is the native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. And we're going to be talking with her about spring blooming native plants during the program. And we'll also talk with her about what's happening in the native garden. The garden tours that are coming up, the Friends of the Arboretum's annual plant sale. I know a lot of you are interested in that one. And, of course, we're taking your native gardening questions or comments, and I hope you'll join in. What signs of spring are you seeing in your garden? Lots going on in my flower gardens. What native plant questions do you have? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Susan Carpenter, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, great to be here, Larry.
You know, my daughter's graduating from college this weekend, and then next week she's going to be with me for several days before she takes off for her new job. But one thing, I'm definitely going to get her over to the Arboretum, because this is the L time of the year at the Arboretum.
Well, it has been a very popular place, as it usually is, but especially at this time of year. So we have a lot of, well, besides a few native plants blooming, we have all our flowering trees, and our horticultural collection is just gorgeous right now. So we have lots and lots of visitors. Maybe you and your daughter could come on a weekday to...
Yeah, that's what we're going to do.
But there'll still be a lot of visitors. It's just a wonderful, wonderful time of year. Of course, the weather this week has been just ideal. So we have lots of activity, and lots of the volunteers are back in the garden, and the volunteers are working hard on the plant sale. So everything is, just everything's buzzing around here.
Yeah, I like to go over and I find a lilac tree, and I lie down on the grass and look up at the sky and breathe deeply.
Yes, good idea. Yep, we've got about, I've got the word from our curator of the horticultural garden. So as far as the lilacs are concerned, earlier this week, a couple days ago, he reported that 30% of the collection is in bloom. And so additional flowering is going on now because of the warm temperatures we've had this week. And peak bloom expected to begin over the weekend, this weekend. So remembering that our lilac collection has early, mid, and late season flowering bushes in it. So you can't see all of them on the same day. But if you want to come, you know, a few times, then you could see all the different varieties or selections. So it's very, it's just beautiful right now. And yeah, we were working outside in the native plant garden right next to the some of the lilacs, and so we could have the scent of lilacs while we were working on native plants this morning.
How are your native plants looking in the garden there?
Things are looking good. With the, you know, it was a very dry winter, and so it was kind of, it's been a little slow getting started, but then we had the rain last week, and we've had the warmer temperatures, and that combination really pops everything. So we, I guess the largest thing that's blooming right now, and people are probably aware of this who have allergies, is are the oaks. So all that pollen, oak pollen, is scattering around now. But they are a beautiful, you know, it makes for a beautiful color of the trees. All the different trees have their leaves out at, and their flowers out at different stages. So you've got all the different colors of green that are possible. As far as the small plants go, we have some shooting stars in bloom and prairie smoke and sweet grass. It's a grass, but it smells kind of like vanilla.
Yeah.
And that's one of the earliest blooming species. So that's blooming. And some of our sedges are pretty much done blooming already, those very early ones. So it's kind of it's just an active time, and it's lots more to come because all the buds are the stems are growing and the buds are growing, the leaves are expanding, and everything's happening at once.
Yeah. So then, you know, maybe talk a bit more about what native plants provide for our birds and animals and insects at this time of the year.
Ah, that's a great question. We do still have some, you know, there are still seeds and material available for birds and voles and mice and so forth that are living, you know, in the thatch underneath the plant, the older plants from last year. And when we clear those away a little bit to just give, we don't take them all away, but just clear a little bit for the ground to be exposed a bit more in the young plants that are coming up to be growing, we find little nests, like little mouse nests or insects, holes in stems where insects have hatched out already. So there's lots of material. The older material has overwintering forms in it. And so it's kind of nice at this time of year if you're just taking some of that off your garden to put it in a pile, maybe in the back of the yard somewhere, so that anything else can hatch out of it. Of course, all insects hatching out at this time are being looked for by some of our bird species. So the swallows are nesting now, the bluebirds are nesting, and they have eggs right now. But as soon as those eggs hatch, there'll be the little baby birds will need insects to eat, so caterpillars and other insects. So birds are collecting those. And the native plants are the plants that all of these animals have evolved with. So they have special close relationships and sometimes ways that other ornamental plants just don't have relationships with our native insects and with our native animals. So that's kind of the benefit. And there's just the exuberance of growth at this time. So even, you know, the plants get growing so fast that even the rabbits and the deer can't keep up with nibbling them back down again.
I look at some of my plants and I swear they grew 4 or 5 inches from one day to the next. It's absolutely amazing. Well, let's talk about the home gardener. What are a few plants gardeners could add to their gardener that can really help those pollinators in the spring?
Yeah, well, some of the good plants to think about in the early spring are the flowering, because those early insects, whether they're solitary insects or whether they're like the queen bumblebees that come out that are out at this time of year, they need nectar to feed themselves and they need pollen to begin laying eggs. If they're solitary bees, they need to lay eggs and provision those with pollen. And bumblebees need to start colonies and provision their eggs with pollen. So some really good sources right now growing at this time of year would be like flowering trees or flowering large shrubs, like the wild plum, the service berry or juneberry, it's also known as.
Yeah.
Those have lots of flowers on, you know, a single plant. Another one that's even earlier than now that's very popular is are the willows. So the male willow trees have the pussy willows, and those are the pollen source. So lots of bees, early bees, will visit those. We even have some solitary bees that are ground nesting that have finished their life cycle for this year already.
Wow.
So they won't be emerging until next April again. But so those are some suggestions. And then if you have a woodland area, the spring ephemerals can be very helpful for some of these early insects too. So when you think about the woods in the spring, the mesic woods, you know, like the maple woods or the oak woods, you have an understory that's got a lot of wildflowers in it. Those will be visited very much by, so examples would right now blooming would be bluebells. We still see some trout lily. You might have, I mean, Dutchman's breeches is pretty well finished by now. But, you know, depending on your exact location, you might have a little sheltered spot where you might be able to grow things like on the north side of your house or under big trees, create that kind of woodland garden, very important for this early spring. And if you don't have a woodland garden, you can go with maybe some of those trees or go with some shooting star and prairie smoke. Those are both bumblebee pollinated, and pretty soon we'll be seeing the lupins blooming, and that's a very nice one for some of those larger pollinators too. Of course, milkweed. I saw milkweed about 6 to 8 inches tall the other day, and that tells me that I'm going to be seeing monarchs pretty soon. So,
woo!
Yep.
There's lots. There's. What do you think about, you know, there's native hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Nativars, I guess we're called. Do you use them?
I don't use them in the native plant garden, and it gets a little tricky because sometimes a nativar has been modified in a way that is okay. So I'll give an example. I've seen the cultivar of the oxeye or early sunflower. Yeah. Early sunflower in its wild type is a fairly tall plant with, you know, lots of stalks and beautiful kind of golden yellow flowers on it. I've seen a cultivar of it that actually tops out quite a bit shorter. So for a certain garden setting, you might think, well, that's the same plant. I can, you know, I like it a little shorter. I could plant that nativar. But then in observation, what I found studying an area where those were growing and where pollinators were present on other plants, that nothing visited it.
Yeah.
So some of it's tricky because there has been research on some of the cultivars and showing, you know, in comparison studies, showing that pollinators will visit them just as much or even more maybe than the wild type.
But we'll talk some more about that. We can definitely visit some more about nativars, but we'll be talking a whole lot about our native plants for the next half hour with Susan Carpenter, and you'll be able to join in, and I hope you will. 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. Today we're talking about native plants and how they maybe can be affected by climate change, but maybe native plants that you would like to grow. Are you having some issues with them? Will you have questions about them? Susan Carpenter is back to help you out. She is the Native Plant Garden Curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Great to have her back. And we'll also be talking about the Arboretum and take your questions and comments about it as well. But what would you like to know about adding native plants to your landscape? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I don't know. We touched a bit on native ours. Anything else that you wanted to say about them? You've got certainly have issues, some issues with them, at least, Susan.
Well, I think that one thing that's kind of neat now is we've got a lot more. We've actually in recent years had new nurseries springing up and new native plant nurseries and new sources for getting native plants, partly because it's so popular to garden with them. And I would just urge people to try the straight native plants in the correct situations, you know, like match if you have a wet area, then plants that like a wetter spot. Full sun, you know, shade, you just kind of match up the plant with the spot. But there will be a certain amount of experimenting to see how they work. And then you can make observations, like I was saying before, of what does that, how does that plant, you know, what are the pollinators that visit it? How does that plant respond in the spot that you picked? And you can move them or you could replace them if you find no pollinators ever visit. You could replace it with a plant that might be more attractive. So we're really kind of inviting nature into our gardens. That's really the way I think of it.
Yeah.
So it's a fun and challenging way of gardening. But we have so many sources now that really I think people being so interested in this kind of gardening are making more opportunities to get native plants for your situation, whatever it might be.
Anne emailed. She's wondering what kind of natives she could put under Norway pine tree line that will act as sort of a natural green mulch. Difficult growing area due to light and dry ground because of tree thirst.
Mm-hmm. Well, that dry and dark can be a challenging situation. I think I would stick with the edges of that area. And then you could really use, if you want kind of a ground cover effect, if the sun, think about where the sun is relative to where the trees are. And, for example, I have a row of very mature arborvitae here at the Arboretum. And on the west side of that row, underneath them, underneath their drip line, but still exposed to some late afternoon sun, we have been growing the long-beaked sedge, which is called Sprengel's sedge as well. And it's about a foot tall, grows in clumps, and you can plant it in there, and it fills in nicely. And then you can grow between them. You can grow other small plants like woodland phlox or bishop's cap that's blooming now, columbine, and, you know, so plants that are not super tall but can grow amongst that kind of gives a little bit foot tall, ground cover effect,
and pretty too. I think
it is. Yeah,
it would go nice in that kind of setting. Mm-hmm. Well, the plant sales are coming along this time of the year. You know, I was thinking back a couple of years ago. I was on my walk and somebody was putting in a rain garden in my neighborhood, and they said, "Oh, we need some plants. We don't know what to do." And it happened to be that weekend was the Arboretum plant sale. So I sent them off to that.
Terrific. Yep, we've got our plant sale this year. The big tent sale is coming up on May 17th, so a week from Saturday, and that is from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. or as long as plants, as long as we aren't sold out. So I would say aiming for the earlier part of the morning would be good. Friends of the Arboretum may begin shopping at 9. So if someone belongs to Friends of the Arboretum, then they can come a bit earlier. So we'll have quite a selection of plants on our website, arboretum.wisc.edu, link to the Friends, and there's a list of the plants that will be at the sale. I mean, assuming that the nurseries can provide all of them. And so it's quite a long list and something for everything, and we'll have some information before you go into the tent about the habitat preference of each of them. So there'll be like partial sun, shade, and full sun categories, because sometimes someone's looking for something particular for their garden.
Yeah, and probably water.
Yes, in the tent, each plant will have its water. Requirements there. Plus, we will have people in the tent that you can ask questions to if you have any questions about whether that plant is right for your situation.
Yeah, all good. So May 17th, 10
yep,
to
10, 10 to 2.
And if you're a member, you can come at 9.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work to be a member?
Well, you just if you are a member of the Friends of the Arboretum, or if you join Friends of the Arboretum, that you can even join it that day, then you'll be able to shop at 9.
So,
or get in line.
Yeah, or get in line. I'd probably try and do it online.
We do have some in the tent. We will have some kits and collections of plants, so you could, for a certain situation, like a pollinator collection of plants, the Rusty Patch Bumblebee mix is available this year, and so that's a group of plants that would all be suitable for, beneficial for bumblebees, not just the Rusty Patch Bumblebee, but that one too. And so that's another way to handle it if you know, like, oh, I'm so interested in pollinators, you can just get a set like that. We have the Monarch set and the Hummingbird set.
But you don't have the Jumping Worm set.
No, we do not have the Jumping Worms. these plants are all from nurseries, so they are not donated from gardens where we might have that problem.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. Oh, I had something in my head, and it just popped back in. What are some other good resources for native plants?
Well, you mean to learn about them?
Yeah.
Well, some favorites would be one favorite that's a pretty recent book that's just so comprehensive is Neil DeBol and Hilary Cox's book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. So for those of you who are growing plants out in the open and more of a sunny garden, this book has all the information. It shows the plant after it germinates. It shows the little tiny plant. It shows the plant fully grown. It shows a picture of the flowers. It shows the picture of the plant in the wintertime. So it's just comprehensive. And that's a very good resource. Some of the guides, like the Arboretum Woodland Wildflower Guide or the Prairie Plant Guide. If you're familiar with the Arboretum, those are kind of nice because you've probably seen the plants out on the grounds.
Yeah.
And then you can, you can read more about them. It's at a good intermediate level, not too technical, not too simple. So those are some nice resources too.
There they are. Sergio emailed, he'd like to know, in general, how long does it take for native plant seeds to grow? And is there anything that he needs to do to get them to grow well? He's trying to plant them in front of his house, which faces the north side.
Okay. So the north side can be a good place to be growing the plants because it's usually a little more moist and a little cooler, so it doesn't dry out and kind of bake in the sun as much as the south side would. Starting from seeds can be somewhat tricky in that some of the species require the seed to basically be cold and moist for a month or 2 months or maybe even 3 months before it will break dormancy and germinate. So if I were to get some seeds right now of a plant that had that kind of requirement and they've been dry all winter, they haven't been outside, then I would not see them germinating this year because they haven't had that cold, moist treatment. If, on the other hand, I had a species that didn't have a requirement like that, an example would be like purple prairie clover. Might not be the best for the north side, but that's a sun-loving plant, and it doesn't have a seed a requirement for, to break dormancy. Yeah. The seeds will just grow. And most of the grasses will just grow right away as soon as you plant them, water them. It may take a year or two, depending on the plant and the conditions, for it to, be fully grown and germinate, and bloom and everything, set seeds. But if you start with a small plant, or if you've started the seeds in like the nurseries do in the greenhouse, so they've been growing throughout the winter, those plugs will become full grown this year if they're planted out. So one way to do it at home sometimes is to get a few plugs, a few or small pots of plants, and then add seed as possible. And then you have kind of a garden to start with, but you're also adding more later.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Jim was wondering about the issue or any issues that came up in the Arboretum. And I would add to this your own property because you have a very nice native area of your own. Were there problems relating to disease or weather that created problems for natives, either at the Arboretum or I'll add in your own property?
Well, I haven't had any problems that in particular with disease that I know of. I mean, there's, when nature has a lot of things that happen.
So for
conditions like a moist year, there might be more fungal, there might be more fungal diseases that that come up. But over time, I've found the native plants to be very resilient. I can't think of anything in particular that I would warn about that. And what was the other part of that?
Oh, I think just disease and,
Yeah, and pests maybe.
Pests.
One thing I notice with pests is if you have native plants and you aren't using pesticides like insecticides or anything on them, you do tend to have a pretty rich fauna of beneficial insects as well as like caterpillars eating leaves. So if you have caterpillars eating leaves, first of all, most of those caterpillars are going to be captured by birds. And so some of the caterpillars will be reproducing and creating more of whatever species it is. And, kind of in a, more modest way, not like overpopulating. So the beneficial insects, for example, just yesterday, I found a very large ground beetle. They're normally out at night feeding on around the ground, feeding on pest insects. But there it was. We kind of disturbed it, I guess, when we were collecting material off of the garden, dried material. So they're there. They're present in these kinds of gardens, and we're not using insecticides. So I think having those levels of beneficial insects and predator levels, that kind of helps take care of some of the issues with maybe what we would consider pest species. Also, like Japanese beetles, we don't have much of that because there's very few of the native plants that they're attracted to. And also that they do damage to. And also, we don't have much turf grass, which is where they complete their life cycle.
I was thinking about this. I was talking with Mark Lane about his new book prior to you joining us, mm-hmm. The Future of Gardens. And it came up that natives, they have evolved in harmony. I think he put it this way. They've evolved in harmony with the climate nuances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're very resilient. I mean, a plant that really, you know, we've just look at the last few years, we see plants that do well with either medium moisture or a lot of moisture, and you get a drought, they'll just be shorter. They'll still reproduce, they'll still flower, but they'll be shorter because of the drought. You know, and then like last year we had the first half of the year was very wet and the second half was a drought. So we had plants that got big and they got dry. So if they completed their life cycle already, they were, you know, there was no effect. And so there's all these, you know, different conditions and these changing conditions. I still think that native plants are the best way to create a resilient landscape because they have had extremes. They have had, you know, they have had they've been through these conditions. I mean, not individual plants, but the species have been through these through conditions before. And we could guess what the new conditions are, but we could be wrong. So if we switch things over to some, you know, guess that we have, we could be totally wrong. So we could let the plants help us figure out what's coming next.
Very, very good points. The Arboretum always has great opportunities for the public to enjoy the gardens. And earlier we were certainly talking about right now is a perfect time to be out there. And then you've got the sale, plant sale on May 17th. But you have other events that are coming up. I want to talk about any of the other upcoming.
We do. Yeah, we've got, we're talking about gardens. We have our garden tour series that goes on it's kind of I don't know, maybe not a well-kept secret, but it's certainly listed in our events. But it's very, really fun. And this Saturday on May 10th from 1 to 3, there's going to be a tour given by our horticultural specialist, Neil Schmidt. And this will be in the Longenecker Horticultural Garden. And it's the spring highlights. So I would expect that would be a very interesting and well-attended tour. And then in June, there'll be a couple of them on Wednesday evenings. And so June 11th and June 25th, I'll be doing two tours on those two dates starting at 7 p.m. And that seems late, but it stays light until 9 o'clock. So we'll be there to talk about the native plants in June. And then it continues on. We have some other summer tours and then fall tours. So that's just the kind of the garden tour part, not counting the regular weekly tours on Sunday afternoons at 1 o'clock that are led by our naturalists. And all of those are free.
Yeah, there's great, great, great opportunities. I'm wondering, are there any changes coming to the Arboretum? Anything?
Well, we have had a lot of changes with our staff. We've had some, you know, new retirements and new staff coming on board. So we've got our new research fellows that have just been awarded their research funds for the summer. We've got all of our student crews coming on board for the summer. I think there's 12 or so student employees who are getting started in the next week or two to help us with outdoor work and the trails and all kinds of things. So it's a really pretty exciting time for all of us to be, you know, working with new people on new things and
you
it's
have
a new
to,
season.
And you always work with a lot of volunteers. How do people join in and what kind of opportunities?
Yes. Well, we have numerous opportunities. So the best way to find out about those is to look at our website and on Get Involved tab. There'll be volunteers. Lots of different things. We have the drop-in ecological restoration work parties for people who like to work out in the woods and the prairies and so on, doing invasive species work and brush work and just helping out on the land itself. We've got garden volunteers, both native plant garden and Longenecker Horticultural Garden. We've got indoor jobs, if people like to work in as a receptionist at a welcome desk or as a bookstore clerk. So there's numerous opportunities. I can't even list them all in the time we have.
Well, Jennifer wonders, how is the jumping worm problem affecting the Arboretum?
That's a very good question. We have, of course, the ongoing research. Our now former ecologist, Brad Herrick, moved on. He's now the director at Lakeshore Nature Preserve, but he is still continuing on with the research project that he had going here. Luckily, he didn't go very far. So we are still studying that, and we have in the native plant garden, because we've had the jumping worms there for approximately 15 years now. I'm noticing less of an effect certainly now than there was at the beginning. Now, that is to say, less evidence of them in, you know, new areas. They're still there, they're still present, but at lower numbers. But I don't know very much yet, and I think this is something the research is uncovering, about the follow-on effect. So, like, after 10 years, what are some of the follow-on effects? And so we do have research ongoing here, and Brad Herrick, who's now at Lakeshore, is the best person to find out the absolute latest about that.
Susan, it is always a pleasure, Susan. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's great to have you come by, and hopefully you'll come back and be with us again.
I sure will, and I hope I see you over here with your daughter next week.
I'll be lying on the grass under.
Okay, well, when I hear about that, I'll look for you.
Thanks, Susan.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Susan Carpenter, the native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Oh, man. It's always fun to talk with her. She's a great talker, by the way. Melinda Myers is going to be back next week on Garden Talk. So we'll cover the broad range of questions that Melinda can answer. And then in the last half hour, Erwin Goldman is back to talk about vegetables. He's a beet guy and has got himself a really wonderful new beet. So I'm looking forward to that. And then on Monday, we're going to talk to the author of two books on, we talk to the author of two books on composting and how you can compost no matter where you live or how big your space is. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us here for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. If you have a small yard, or even if you live in apartments, you can still get into composting, and our next guest can tell you how. With us today, Michelle Baltz. She is the author of two books. One's titled No Waste Composting. The other is titled Composting for a New Generation. She also writes a blog. It's titled Confessions of a Composter. Michelle also teaches classes on backyard composting. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Love to hear from you and maybe your efforts to compost. Would you like some advice? What questions do you have about composting maybe in a small place? Join the conversation. You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michelle Baltz, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Larry.
You call yourself a compost fanatic. Why are you so passionate about composting?
Well, so I find it absolutely fascinating that and just really empowering that you can take things like banana peels that people normally think of as trash, and you can turn it into your a beautiful homemade compost. It's a wonderful crumbly material that is, you know, any gardener will tell you that it is one of the best things you can add to your soil to help your plants. I just find the whole process really fascinating. In fact, my Instagram handle is Compost Geek because I just love to learn all about the different techniques, and I just find so much satisfaction in putting the materials in and then harvesting the finished compost. It's almost like baking your own bread or, you know, making a homemade quilt. You're making your own compost at home. I love it.
How long have you been doing this? And how did you get involved with it?
So I've been doing it for over 20 years. And, well, if you count when I was a child composting in my parents' garden longer than that, but on my own at my own house for a little over 20 years. And I started because I work for a local government down here in Ohio, and we were giving classes on backyard composting. So we're in a waste district where we're trying to reduce waste going to the landfill. And the more I learned about composting, the more fascinating I found it. So I started a blog to kind of put all those ideas in place. And then that led to a publisher reaching out to me and asking if I'd write a book. And I was like, sure, that sounds fun.
Well, Jeff in Door County already has a question for you. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, guys. So I built a compost bin out of some pallets like probably 3 years ago. And I've been, but I haven't turned it in those 3 years. And I'm wondering, is it even something that I can regenerate or?
Yeah. What's gone into it, Jeff?
Various clippings from the garden, trees. I've got about an acre and a half up here. So it's all different kinds of stuff. And I put soil in there as well. So, but no food.
No food. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he hasn't turned the compost pile in a few years now, and wondering what he can do to kind of rejuvenate it maybe.
Yeah, you know, that's the great thing about backyard composting is it is very forgiving. So you likely have, it may look like on the outside it hasn't done anything, but if you dig down into it, I bet you have finished compost that you could harvest in the center of it. You know, that there's still micro, biotic activity that's happening in the center of that compost bin. And so what I would do is pull the material out, right? Anything that's not finished composting, it's usually the stuff that's on the outside since you haven't been turning it, you know, move that continue composting. But I bet once you dig in there, you're going to find some really beautiful compost on the inside.
I would think after 3 years, I think he said that there's got to be some good compost in there. What really, you know, you mentioned microbes. What's really the science behind composting? How does it all work?
You know, there are microorganisms that do most of the work. So bacteria, fungi. And as it goes through the process, it'll heat up a little bit, and different organisms will, mostly at the beginning, it is the macro organisms, so the worms and the, beetles and the bigger bugs. And then as it heats up, it's a lot of the bacteria breaking it down. And at the end, you'll notice you see still kind of woody material. The fungus is what will get that. And the fungus takes the longest amount of time, which is probably why the caller, you're going to see some really beautiful compost because you've let it sit there for a few years. it will eventually break down all of that woody material as well, but that takes longer.
Mike in Algoma has a question for you. Mike, hello.
Yeah, good morning. It's a crazy question, but why do we need to put green and brown material in a compost pile when all green material turns brown if you leave it long enough? What's going on?
Okay, that's a good point, Mike.
Yes. So it's really all about the balance of nitrogen and carbon. And it goes back to those microorganisms again. They need both materials in order to get the energy that they have, but also to reproduce and to create new, basically, cells. They have to have the nitrogen and the carbon. And when they just have one, I mean, anything that you put in the pile is going to have some level of nitrogen and some level of carbon. So it will eventually decompose, right? As long as it's an organic material. But, wood is going to have a lot more carbon. It's going to take that longer to decompose. Things like leaves will have a little bit more nitrogen in them. So they will eventually decompose and it'll be fine. It just is slower. So if you add food scraps, for example, if you have a leaf bin and all you want to add are coffee grounds, which are actually high in nitrogen, despite being the color brown, they are high in nitrogen, you will turn out really nice compost. It will have a great balance of carbon and nitrogen, and you don't really need to add any other food scraps to it than those coffee grounds. So it's really just getting that balance. You want about one part nitrogen to two to three parts carbon, and you'll get the fastest possible decomposition.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say it's a speed question.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be faster if you add both.
That's right.
Okay. Bonnie in Mesa, Maine has a question or comment. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I have a question, too. I've got an outside compost bin that I keep turning, and it still turns out pretty slowly. I'm looking at either food mills or electric composters for the kitchen so that mm-hmm. I can kind of pre-process material from the kitchen, not protein stuff, but just, the coffee grounds and peels and vegetable matter.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you have any advice on that.
Yeah, so if listeners aren't aware, there are some devices out there that you can buy for your kitchen. They're basically like pre-composters. They're not actually composting in them, but they grind up the food scraps and dehydrate them. And it turns it into a material that kind of looks like soil, but it is not. It is just little tiny pieces of dehydrated food scraps. But it is pre-processing it, and that will decompose faster in a compost bin. It will also be less likely to attract rodents if you're worried about that. So it will work faster. It's especially nice if you have a tumbler that's up off the ground and you're trying to make compost really fast. They are kind of expensive. And like I said, you do need to still compost them afterward. So just be aware that it's kind of a pre-processing step. I've never personally used one, but I've talked to other composters that have and love them, especially if they have a really small backyard and they're trying to, and they kind of feel a little icky about the food scraps. It helps take that ick factor away.
Okay, Bonnie. How expensive are those, Michelle? Those electric.
I think they're a couple hundred dollars. Yeah, it's not cheap, but it can be a nice device if you're into gadgets.
Well, and I think I was looking through some of your information online, and you do talk about cutting things up or chopping them up a bit as a way to get things going a lot faster. You can use a knife for that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. If you've got things like watermelon rinds, it's good to chop them up a little bit. Your pumpkins, before you put them in there, I usually throw mine on the ground, maybe stomp on it just to break it up. The more broken surfaces you'll have, the faster those microorganisms are going to eat it, basically. So if you want it broken up, that's the best way.
You've got lots of different ways to compost. What's the in your book, for sure, what's the simplest way to compost?
So I think the best way, if you're starting out, is to buy one of those, you know, black plastic compost bins that sit right on the ground. They're open to the earth. Some of them look like, you know, Darth Vader helmets.
Mm-hmm.
But the black plastic, buy two of them. And I think that they're nice because they hold in moisture. Most of them have locking lids. And it's a good way to get started. I like to say fill it up about, a foot with shredded leaves. And then every time you add food scraps, cover them up with more leaves. So I have a wire leaf bin next to the black plastic bin. And the reason I say two is once you filled up one, you can just leave it to do its thing and then start on another one. And you don't have to try to be messing with the food scraps that aren't quite finished.
And that's relatively inexpensive, too. I mean, in order to get started.
Yeah, and some communities even have compost bin sales where you can buy them a little, you know, less expensive. But yeah, I think that those are really the easiest way to get started composting. Unless you want to start with just leaves in a wire bin, then maybe that's a little simpler.
So I notice as I have friends and so forth are going through the neighborhood that you'll see the compost bins. Most of them are in the far back corner of the lawn. Is that the best place for it? I mean, people just want it out of the way.
Yeah, and you know that's funny because that's where I have mine, but I have a pretty small backyard. And it's on the other side of the fence of my neighbor's compost bin, so that works out well. But, yeah, I feel like you want it within easy walking distance of your house, so it depends on how big your yard is. But you don't want it so close that, you know, there are going to be bugs. So, you know, there's going to be things attracted to it. So you don't want it right up against your house. You also, if you have a wood fence, you don't want to put it up against your wood fence because it will start to decompose the wood fence. So you want it a little bit away from that. But as long as it's an easy walking distance, I think you'll be fine.
And what about those folks who live in an apartment? You say they can do some composting.
Absolutely. So in my second book, No Waste Composting, I actually spent a whole chapter talking about ways that you could compost indoors or on a, you know, fire escape or small patio. Because I got a lot of questions about those methods. So, you know, there's the vermicomposting with worms, which is, you know, the most longstanding kind of indoor compost method. And that is a fantastic way to compost. In fact, you'll get the highest quality compost that you can make at home from the vermicastings or the worm poop. But not everybody wants to have 1,000 worms in a little bin in their kitchen or their basement. So I did research some other methods, and those are highlighted in the book. One of them is really cool from India. They're terracotta pots that stack on top of each other. And you want to do it out like on a balcony or a patio, but you don't need a yard. And you use coconut core, so like the fibrous material when they make coconut milk and, you know, and the coconut, it's a nice carbon material because another problem that people in apartments have is they don't have a bunch of leaves that they can compost. They've got the food scraps, but they need the carbon material. And so that acts as your carbon material. I tried to pull together a whole list of different options for people.
One of the methods that I saw was relating to keyhole gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Describe a keyhole garden and how it works.
Yeah, so a traditional keyhole garden is going to be one that if you imagine a circle and then it has a little notch cut out of it so that you can walk to the center of the circle. And these were developed in Africa and in really arid regions of Africa where they were having, you know, they have water shortages and they still want to grow vegetables. And so they'll build a wall, so it's a raised garden bed, and in the center is a compost bin. It's usually made out of wire material, something that is going to, you know, be able to mix with the soil around it in the garden. And so you plant whatever around the compost bin. You put your food scraps and brown materials into the compost, but then you water just the compost bin. And the compost bin acts as a way to then, you know, water all and give nutrients to the plants surrounding it. So really interesting idea, and something that I got to build when I was writing the book, and it was a lot of fun. And you can build it out of stone or pavers or bricks, or I even saw one built out of old wine bottles, which was interesting. But you can pretty much build it out of what, you know, whatever your imagination lets you try to find, you know, an idea of.
I thought the photos were pretty attractive. It was unusual and pretty attractive at the same time. I loved it. Michelle Beltz, our guest today, author of two books, one, No Waste Composting, and the other, Composting for a New Generation. And she writes a blog titled Confessions of a Composter. Questions? There's an open line. Get you on pretty quickly here at 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Talking about composting today with Michelle Beltz, author of two books, No Waste Composting and Composting for a New Generation, and her blog, Confessions of a Composter. Nancy in Appleton emailed, she collects vegetable scraps to make vegetable stock with. Are these still valuable to compost after cooking, and is the addition of salt problematic?
That's a great question, and I actually do that as well. I make stock out of my old vegetable scraps. I keep them in a bag in the freezer until I've had enough, and then I throw them in a pot. And then once you've boiled them, they're actually going to decompose faster. So they're great for the backyard bin. That little bit of salt that you put in there is really not going to affect the bin too much. I mean, salt isn't something that you want to be adding a whole lot of to your backyard compost bin, but the amount that, you know, we would like to eat is fine. It's good. That little bit of salt isn't going to matter in the backyard bin, and they will decompose faster.
Jerry in Oconomowoc has a question. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Michelle, I'm in southeastern Wisconsin, and it gets pretty cold here in the winter, and I've been garbage can composting all summer with holes in the plastic bins outside. And so I've just gotten a bin in my garage and a heating pad on it and 500 red wigglers. any hints for me on how I can speed up that compost process in my garage?
You know, I would say try to keep those red wigglers as happy as possible. And, you know, they can eat half their body weight in food scraps a day. And I know when you start out the bin, you don't want to feed them that much. They need a little bit, you know, they get a little shock when they first get into a new environment. But as long as you're keeping them, the right moisture is really important. They need to be a little moist. You don't want them to dry out, but they also can't, you know, they're not aquatic. They don't want to be completely covered in water. So you need to make sure it's the right moisture. And I would also recommend not putting a lot of citrus peels in there. I've noticed in my worm bins that if I add citrus, that for some reason these little white bugs start growing in there. And I don't know if it's the pH or what, but I just haven't had a lot of success with citrus in worm bins. But other than that, they can take pretty much any food scrap, and they will end up churning out some really nice finished compost.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you for calling. Dennis in Mauston, we turn to you. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good morning. First-time caller, long-time composter. So I live in central Wisconsin, and our soil is extremely high in phosphorus. And it was always a problem growing things in the garden, so I decided to start doing raised bed gardening. And my raised beds are basically what I call living compost piles. In other words, as I'm growing in them and throughout the year, I'm constantly adding kitchen scraps, grass clippings, ground-up leaves from the previous fall, compost from my compost bins. And when I recently had a soil test, and I expected my NPK was going to be perfect, it came back with my phosphorus extremely high. Any thoughts on why that's happening?
That's a good question. I don't know much about the Wisconsin soils and that high phosphorus. We don't have that problem here in Ohio, or at least down in Cincinnati. I do know that, so one of the methods that I talk about in no waste composting is about using, taking a raised bed and doing Hugel culture in the bottom of it, which sounds a little similar to what you're talking about, where you kind of line the bottom of a pretty deep raised bed with woody material and then manure, and then you put your regular soil and compost and things on top of that and grow on top of that. And what that does, I think, would create a little bit more of a barrier between that soil that you're trying not to grow in and the nice amended soil that you're growing on the top there. It also very slowly over decades breaks down, and so it acts like a sponge and helps keep that. But I'm not sure if maybe there's food scraps that you're adding to the compost that is kicking up the phosphorus. I'm not really sure.
Well, it could be. You're growing in high phosphorus soil, so maybe those plants are a little higher in phosphorus as well to keep that phosphorus level up. Dennis, there you go. Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. Mike in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hey, Larry and Michelle. We have a lot of maple trees in our neighborhood, in a small backyard. So, but there's a lot of black spots,
tar spot
disease on our leaves. And so, is it okay to use those in the compost, or would that cause harm?
You know, I think it's better to keep those out of the compost. You know, not knowing exactly what kind of disease that is, you don't know that your backyard compost is going to get hot enough. Commercial composting likely would kill any of those diseases, but you'd have to get up to 140 degrees in your backyard bin to make sure that you killed all of that, and you just can't guarantee that. A lot of backyard systems don't get that hot, and so I would air on the safe side and bring that to a commercial composter.
Yeah. I know tar spot is pretty cosmetic for the maple trees, but, you know, that. So whether or not that would have an impact, I'm not sure either. But you can, as Michelle says, maybe you might want to err on the safe side for something like that. And Natalie in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Natalie.
Hello. So I live in an apartment, but I am lucky enough to have parents that compost. So I save my food scraps and bring it to them. The compost kind of food scrap container that I bought came with compostable bags. And I'm just curious, is that actually something I should be using? Because I notice when I bring the bags, when I bring another bag, the old bag is still there. And I just feel like it's maybe not breaking down as well.
Yeah, so there's a lot of products out there that say they're compostable or biodegradable, and I do air quotes when I say that, and they don't break down. Now, there is, and this is not sponsored, but I have noticed that there's a brand called BioBag that does seem to break down pretty well in a backyard bin. My sister-in-law years ago gave me a present of some compostable bags, and so I've been trying them. And it took probably 2 years for those bags to break down, and they were pretty annoying while they were breaking down.
Yeah.
Because they were just kind of like shredded pieces of plastic in my bin. So my recommendation, unless it's a bio bag, is to, you know, you could use it as a liner, but just treat it like a regular plastic bag and just empty the scraps into the compost and then throw away the bag.
Natalie, thank you so much. Michelle, thank you so much. Will you come back and be with us again? It'd be really fun to have you back.
I would come back anytime. Thanks for having me.
Michelle Balt's our guest. Her books, No Waste Composting and Composting for a New Generation, and her blog, Confessions of a Composter. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.